Blog Talk Radio.
Whatever we do, Freemasons, part of the human context, we don't seem to do very much unless we can achieve some sense of meaning, whether it's positive or negative. This constant curiosity that drives us forward is about, I would say, searching for meaning. Not everybody tends to do that, or everybody tends to do it, but perhaps not consciously. We have to understand. We dialogue. We have conversations. There's a lot of interesting things going on around us. I'm going to warm up with you. I hope you, if you're sitting back in a comfortable spot with your favorite beverage du jour in hand. Around here right now, I'm commemorating the coffee shops of early London with a cup of strong French roast. Thank you very much. I've got my old dog lying at my feet. It's quiet. It's dark. It's a perfect opportunity to share some time with you. If you don't mind, I'll talk a little bit about the war in 1812, and I'm going to use reference that came from my branch of the Royal Canadian Legion. They're a bit growly about folks like me that didn't bear arms directly. I'm one of the privileged few on the face of the earth that have greatly benefited from the effort and work and bravery of a lot of men and women. Circumstance is what it is in my life, just like it is in everybody's, but certainly I can honor this. And with the November 11th coming up shortly, it's, I think, a good time to talk into this. The origins of the War of 1812 can be found. I'll be brief. I'm not going to be tedious because I know you've got a lot of things in your mind. The origins of the war can be found in the larger conflict that had been waged by revolutionary and imperial France against Britain since 1793. After Nelson's naval victory at Trafalgar in October 1805 had more or less swept the French navy from the seas, Napoleon Bonaparte, the French emperor, turned to economic warfare and prohibited ships that traded with Britain to trade with France, its allies, or conquered territories. Britain countered with legislation forbidding ships that traded with France to trade with Britain. The United States, which had a large merchant marine, was caught in the middle of this war by decree. American frustration was increased by the Royal Navy, which, desperate for manpower, boarded American ships and impressed or conscripted any British seamen on board to them. The result was that many innocent Americans found themselves unwilling sailors of the king. An additional irritant between Britain and the U.S. was unrest on the Republic's northwest frontier, which was threatened by an Aboriginal confederation under the charismatic Shawnee chief Tecumseh, Brother Tecumseh. Many Americans believed that Britain was behind the frontier problems, and by the spring of 1812, the U.S. was preparing for hostilities. Although Britain offered to repeal the maritime decrees that were harming American maritime trade, it was too late. On June 18th, with the rallying cry of free trade and sailors' rights, President James Madison declared war on Great Britain. Wasn't he assassinated later? Anyway, American leaders were confident. Former President Thomas Jefferson remarked that the acquisition of Canada up to the vicinity of Montreal would be a matter of marching. But in its rush to war, Madison's government had overlooked some major problems. Given the Royal Navy's strength, the war against Britain would have to be a land war, and the objective would be the British colonies in North America, commonly called, even at the time, Canada. On paper, it certainly seemed a sure thing, as the U.S. had 10 times the population of British North America. An attack on Canada, however, would require a tremendous logistical effort to supply armies in an area of primitive communication. Worse still, most of the regular American army was deployed in Louisiana and remained there throughout the war. As a result, the U.S. tried to campaign in a distant and difficult theater of war with untrained and poorly supplied troops who were commanded by relics of the Revolutionary War. Ironically, the British North America was actually better prepared for war than its neighbor, and more importantly, it was defended by professional soldiers and sailors. If there is one lesson to learn for modern Canadians to draw from the War of 1812, is that proclaiming sovereignty is not enough. A nation must be prepared to defend it, and to do so it requires professional armed forces. And I would add, not alone. It also requires committed people and a cause and a purpose worth fighting for. Makes it sound like if we hired mercenaries, that would be all it took. But we know better. We know the German mercenaries weren't enough professional. But Canadian Legion article, so I'll give them that. It's quite legitimate. Fortunately, competent British leadership was present, and there were almost as many British regular troops in Canada as there were in the U.S. Army. In July 1812, American General William Hull commenced a rather timid invasion of Upper Canada across the Detroit River. While he prepared to engage this thrust, Brock struck in the upper Great Lakes. On his orders, a small British force traversed Lake Huron and forced the surrender of the American post on Mackinac Island, a success that convinced many of the Aboriginal nations who had remained neutral to join the British side. Shortly afterwards, Hull withdrew to Detroit, but it was not long before Brock, having gathered every regular militiaman and warrior that he could, arrived and prepared to attack. Certainly not the professional soldier. Brock could do this because at the onset of the war, only Britain possessed a navy on the Great Lakes, which was granted him the advantage of mobility, and Brock made good use of it. Bluffing, he called on Hull to surrender Detroit, and to Brock's amazement, the American general did so on the 16th of August, giving up Detroit and the Michigan Territory to a British and Canadian force half its strength. Brock's victory at Detroit was the first major success of the war, and it did much to encourage the people of Upper Canada, who were uncertain that their province would remain British territory. Thank goodness, boys. These early victories on land were unfortunately balanced by defeats at sea. In the years since Trafalgar, the Royal Navy had become overconfident, convinced that its ships could defeat any possible opponent. British sailors failed to realize that the U.S. Navy, although very small, possessed excellent warships and seamen. The result was that American sailors won an impressive series of single-ship encounters. In the first 6 months of the war, the USS Constitution captured the British frigates Gauria and Java. The American sloop Wasp took her counterpart HMS Frolic. The frigate U.S. United States prevailed over the British frigate Macedonia, and the brig USS Hornet captured the British brig Peacock. Britain had not suffered such a series of defeats at sea for more than a century. This did much to restore morale, which had been shaken by defeats on land. In the autumn of 1812, the enemy made another invasion attempt. On the night of October 12th, a small American army of regular troops and militia crossed the Niagara and seized the village of Queenston. Brock, who was at Fort George outside Newark, modern Niagara-on-the-Lake, proceeded to Queenston with all available troops, realizing that the key to the American position was the high ground behind the village. He led an assault against it, only to be killed. The British and Canadians fell back, waiting for reinforcements to arrive, and in the meantime, a detachment of Aboriginal warriors from the Grand River Nations, led by Mohawk War Chief John Norton, also known as the Snipe, kept the enemy off balance. Norton remembered that his men returned the fire of the enemy with coolness and spirit. And although the Americans certainly made the greatest noise, the warriors did the most execution, he said, and the enemy was forced back. More regular troops arrived and pushed the invaders, now surrounded and with no means of escape, to the edge of the Niagara River. Realizing it was hopeless, the enemy commander surrendered, and more than 900 Americans became prisoners of war. The victory at Queenston Heights had a dramatic effect on British North America, and morale was high when the onset of winter brought an end to active military operations. Two major invasions had been repelled, and there was confidence the war would be brought to a victorious end. But Queenston Heights had been a costly victory, for as Norton recorded the grief caused by the loss of Brock, threw a gloom over the sensations which this brilliant success might have raised. Canadian optimism had disappeared in the spring. An intensive building program during the winter gave the U.S. naval superiority on Lake Ontario, and the enemy was quick to take advantage of this. In late April 1813, American ships landed an army near York, now Toronto, the capital of Upper Canada, pushing a far weaker British, Canadian, and Aboriginal force before them. Makes sense that we moved the capital to Ottawa, at least to give us a little breathing room, so in case the rascals ever considered doing it again. I know, it's for in the reaches, but happened once. Pushing a far weaker British-Canadian Aboriginal force before them, the invaders were approaching the town when the ammunition magazine in the military depot at York was ignited to prevent its contents from being captured. A boy who witnessed the explosion remembered that he heard the report and felt a tremendous motion of the earth resembling the shock of an earthquake, and looking towards the spot, I saw an immense cloud ascend into the air, which was a great confused mass of smoke, timber, men, and earth that resembled a vast balloon. After the defenders evacuated York, it was occupied by the enemy for several days, during which they accidentally burned the provincial parliament buildings. This was the beginning of a renewed American offensive against British North America. On the 27th of May, 1813, an invading force crossed the Niagara and captured Fort George. Badly outnumbered, British and Canadian troops withdrew to the area of the modern city of Hamilton, but were pursued by an American force commanded by Generals John Chandler and William Winder. In the early morning of June 6, 1813, it was attacked at Stony Creek by a smaller British force, and during the battle, a hard-fought but confusing fight night went on. The Americans managed to beat off the assault, but both Chandler and Winder were taken prisoner. The invaders retreated, and a few weeks later, another enemy force was sent to capture supplies known to be at John DeCue's house near modern St. Catharines. This expedition also came to an inglorious end, however, in June 24, when forewarned by a housewife named Laura Secourt, a force of warriors surrounded the Americans and forced them to surrender in what was called the Battle of Beaver Dams. After this, the invaders did not venture in strength beyond their lines at Fort George, and the war in Niagara became a stalemate. The same Sunday, the 6th of June, 1813, which witnessed the American defeat at Stony Creek, was also the occasion of a glorious event in Halifax. The evening service at St. Paul's Church in that city was disrupted when somebody delivered the exciting news that a British warship was leading a captured American frigate up the harbor. The effect was electrical. An eyewitness remembered it. In a few minutes, the congregation had abandoned worship to run down George Street to the docks and watch as the British frigate HMS Shannon and her prize, the frigate USS Chesapeake, slowly moved toward the naval dockyard. The same eyewitness recalled that every housetop and every wharf was crowded with groups of excited people who greeted the arrivals with vociferous cheers. And Halifax, he believed, was never in such a state of excitement before or since. The Shannon's triumph over the Chesapeake in a bloody engagement fought off Boston on the 1st of June ended the series of American single ship victories over the Royal Navy. The Royal Navy now began to exert its far superior strength by blockading the U.S. seaboard. Privateers who put out from ports in the maritime provinces assisted the King's sailors. The most successful of these sea raiders was the schooner Liverpool Packet, which took 50 prizes valued at nearly $1 million in $1,813 before herself being captured. Another notable maritime privateers, such as the brig Sir John Sherbrooke and the schooner Retaliation, took fewer prizes, but helped to depredate the American coastal trade, disrupting communications and inevitably causing higher prices on all types of goods. To the west, the war came to life again in the autumn of 1813, following an American victory on the naval battle of Lake Erie fought on September 10th. It resulted in the capture of the entire British squadron on that body of water. British Major General Henry Proctor decided he could no longer maintain his position on the Detroit River and ordered his army to retreat east. Disgusted, his Aboriginal ally, Tecumseh, called Proctor a fat animal that carries its tail upon its back, but when affrighted, drops it between its legs and runs off. The retreat commenced. However, Tecumseh had no choice but to accompany the British and Canadians with his warriors and their families. Unfortunately, on October 5th, a larger American force caught up with the Allied army at the Thames River, not far from the modern city of London, and scattered it. Tecumseh was killed while leading his men. But his followers managed to spirit his body away and bury it in a secret location. The disaster at the Thames, however, spelled the end of British ambitions in the American Northwest. At about the same time, U.S. Secretary of War John Armstrong came north to reinvigorate the American war effort. He planned a two-pronged offensive against Montreal, and with one army to move against that city from Lake Champlain, while another larger force would move down the St. Lawrence in an armada of small boats. These plans went awry when the army from Lake Champlain was defeated at the Battle of Chateauguay, a few miles south of Montreal, on the 26th October, and then hastily withdrew over the border. The victory was earned by entirely Francophone troops under Lieutenant Colonel Charles de Salaberry. The waterborne prong of the U.S. offensive was terminated by a British and Canadian force which had been trailing it down the St. Lawrence River. Annoyed by this irritant snapping at its heels, the enemy turned and attacked. On the 11th of November, 1813, a gray, wet day, the British and Canadian troops were deployed on good defensive ground near the farm of John Chrysler, but the approach of the much larger American force caused some trepidation in the ranks. Lieutenant John Sewell from Quebec City remembered that one of his men exclaimed, "There are too many, we shall all be slaughtered." Sewell coldly told him that it would be better for him to die doing your duty than to be shot for mutiny. But as it happened, after more than 2 hours of costly fighting, the Americans were beaten and hastily withdrew to their own territory, thus ending the largest and most serious American offensive against British North America. General Gordon Drummond, the British commander in Upper Canada, shifted his headquarters to the Niagara Peninsula and reinforced the forces there. Brown, meanwhile, advanced to Lake Ontario, expecting to find the American naval squadron on that body of water ready to support him in attacking Fort George. There were no friendly sails in view, however, as the Royal Navy had gained momentary superiority on the lake, and in frustration, Brown withdrew back to Chippewa to resupply. He was followed by Drummond, who, having reconnoitered the American camp, took up a great offensive position on Sand Hill, not far from the falls. Close by a tree-shrouded, sunken country road called Lundy's Lane. His troops were cooking their dinner in the evening of the 25th July when they were ordered to stand to their arms because the enemy was approaching. A few minutes later, American troops emerged from a chestnut wood to the south and thus began the bloodiest battle of the war. It went on for more than 5 hours into the night, and it was, as one participant remembered, a struggle obstinate beyond description. Casualties on both sides were heavy, including 5 of the 6 British and American generals present who were wounded, and toward the end some units were commanded by sergeants. At several points, the opposing armies crossed bayonets and cases of mistaken identity, with soldiers firing on their own comrades, were frequent in the darkness and confusion. When the shooting died away, more than 1,600 men lay dead or wounded in an area about the size of 2 modern football fields. And as one American remarked, it was a scene I hope I may never see again. be witnessed by human beings. Thank God I have survived it. At the end of the action, however, Brown's army had good cause to claim a victory, as it was in possession of the hill, the high ground. That victory was thrown away, however, by the subordinate general to whom Brown, badly wounded, turned over his command. He ordered a withdrawal to Fort Erie, where he began to construct a fortified camp. A week later, when Drummond arrived before the fort, he found his enemy in a well-entrenched position, plentifully supplied with artillery. The British general commenced a siege, but was hampered by supply problems as the British squadron on Lake Ontario had withdrawn into Kingston after the American naval commander had commissioned a new and large warship. Drummond's supplies now had to come by land, and he shortly began to suffer shortages in food and ammunition. He decided to wager everything on a single throw of the dice and launched an offense the night of August 14th and 15th. It was disastrous. The British and Canadians were repulsed in several places, and the only penetration into the enemy position, a bastion of the stone fort, was brought to a swift end by the accidental explosion of a powder magazine under the feet of the attackers. Witnesses remembered the terrible, terrific explosion and a jet of flame mingled with fragments of timber, earth, stone, and bodies rose 100 feet into the air. The assault was a total failure, and the cost was more than 900 men killed and wounded. Elsewhere during that bloody summer, British arms met with more success. In August, General John Cope Sherbrooke, the Lieutenant Governor of Nova Scotia, launched an expedition against the border ports of Maine, captured Bangor, Castine, and Machias. During their possession of these places, British commanders continued to collect the customs and excise duties on cargoes being landed. And after the war, 10,000 pounds of these monies were put to good use to establish Dalhousie University at Halifax. Thank you very much, in case nobody ever thanked you for that. But we did earn it. Further to the south, a major expedition entered Chesapeake Bay in an effort to draw off American troops from the Northern Theater. In late August, a small British army under General Robert Ross moved on Washington, and at Bladensburg near the American capital, defeated a far superior American force, which included President James Madison, Secretary of War John Armstrong, and Secretary of State James Monroe. The presence of these politicians in the battlefield may have had something to do with the fact that Ross's army occupied Washington that night. Making a point. Over the next few days, they burned military and naval establishments, the legislative buildings, and the presidential mansion, not called the White House then, which under the rules of war, as they were understood at the time, were legitimate military targets. Success at Washington was followed by failure at Baltimore on the 12th of September, when Ross was killed while making a reconnaissance of the defenses of the city. As Baltimore was too strong to be directly attacked, the British contented themselves with a naval bombardment of nearby Fort McHenry using artillery and rockets. A young American lawyer, Francis Scott Key, was so entranced by the sight of gun flashes and explosion that he hastily scribbled a poem which he later set to the music of an old English drinking song. Its first line read, "Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light?" And of course, it later became the U.S. national anthem. Despite all the fireworks, however, the British attack was rebuffed. The major British offensive of the war was made in the north of on Lake Champlain. In the first days of September, a British and Canadian army numbering just over 10,000 men and led by Prevost, crossed into northern New York and advanced on the American naval base at Plattsburgh. It was a confident army. As the troops marched over a bridge at Champlain, New York, almost on the border, the regimental bands played Yankee Doodle as an insult. Brushing aside militia rear guards, Provost reached Plattsburgh on the 6th of September and settled down to wait for the British Lake Champlain squadron, whose assistance was needed for him to take the enemy base. The Royal Navy duly showed up on the 11th of September and immediately engaged the American squadron, guarding the entrance to Plattsburgh Harbor. After a furious action that killed or wounded nearly 250 men in both squadrons, the British squadron was completely defeated and captured. Unable to take Plattsburgh without naval assistance, Prevost decided to withdraw to Canada, and the finest army Britain had ever sent to North America turned on its heels and trudged northward in very low spirits. As the lengthy columns trudged back over the bridge at Champlain, one British soldier remembered an American calling out, I guess as how you are not playing Yankee Doodle now. Some of the officer's men were inclined to have thrown him, the American, in the river, but this was not done. A little tacky, huh? Bad taste. Meanwhile, along the Niagara, General Gordon Drummond had continued his desultory siege at Fort Erie. However, a shortage of food and ammunition forced him to order a withdrawal. Battles, how many generals have repeated the same thing? You have to feed your troops. You have to supply them. His troops were preparing for this on September 17th when the Americans boiled out at the fort and attacked the British siege batteries. They were ultimately repulsed with a loss of over 1,000 men from both sides, but Drummond withdrew to a good defensive position on the north bank of the Chippewa River. Ironically, at almost the same time, the British squadron on Lake Ontario regained naval superiority after it commissioned the warship St. Lawrence, a ship of over 100 guns and the largest warship to sail on the Great Lakes. Unfortunately, she proved to be an expensive white elephant and only made one voyage before returning to Kingston, where she remained for the rest of her brief career. In early November, the American army in the Niagara withdrew to American soil, ending the campaign. A few minor skirmishes and actions followed, but the war was substantially at an end. The seesaw nature of the fighting over the summer and autumn of 1814, which had been closely followed by the diplomats of both nations, had sent to the Dutch city of Ghent to negotiate the peace settlement. As autumn turned to winter, they gradually hammered out an agreement based on the pre-war status quo. A treaty was signed on Christmas Eve, 1814. But news of that had not reached North America in early January 1815, when the final major battle took place at New Orleans, during which the British were repulsed with heavy casualties. 2 months later, the U.S. Congress ratified the Treaty of Ghent, and the war was over. So what was the outcome of this so-called forgotten conflict? That is an easy question to answer. If Britain had not successfully defended her North American colonies, Canada would not exist today. The war was a defining moment in Canadian history, laying the foundation not only for Confederation, but for the modern nation we live in today, independent and free, with a constitutional monarchy, the parliamentary system, and a respect for linguistic and ethnic diversity. That surely is reason enough not only to remember but commemorate the War of 1812. And apart from any of the revisionists, November 11th, this year, perhaps you'll remember the battles. And at Christmas Eve, perhaps you'll remember the signing. What takes us back to our principles, though, is to remember something Right Worship of Brother David Cameron said when we were long ago out at Amherstburg for an international meeting on the island of Bablo. And he said, you know, it's interesting, we're talking about these great battles without remembering the greatest loser of all were the native people that fought with us. Strange creatures we are. Very strange creatures. Let's see what we can come up with. Here's another little bit from 1924. Listen to it. I'll be right back. One of the nice things about this program, I'm trying to look for music written by Freemasons. That's from Rhapsody in Blue, of course, by George Gershwin. And the entrance to the show is always the West End Blues, performed by Oliver. And the horn in the entrance is, of course, Louis Armstrong, brother Louis Armstrong. Let's continue a little bit. You're still with me. I hope you found that interesting. It makes us think about the battles that defined a nation, made us who we are today, truly. We need to be, I think, more than grateful for the efforts of a lot of very, very essential people. Very essential people. We want to take you a little bit, to a discussion of some Masons that may be known to you or not, and just a little refresher, if you don't mind. And this would be more relevant to Freemasons in the crowd. But don't go away if you're not. We're talking about things that are important for people generally. not all great ideas were branded by Freemasonry. The ideas are out there in the minds of men and women. We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, therefore, is not an act, but a habit. That comes from Aristotle. We just heard about some serious battles. Storms make oaks take root. Must have been important, or nobody would have died for it. Seek the lofty by reading, hearing, and seeing great work at some moment every day. It's by Thornton Wilder said that. St. Clement of Alexandria tells us, if you do not hope, you will not find what is beyond your hopes. Makes me wonder sometimes. As you know, that I have this understanding that Freemasonry has expanded up till now, and now is in a period of transition. We're no longer expanding, but we are evolving. We're reaching into the depths to find deeper meaning, quality of the experience of the order. It's a fascinating time to be a Freemason. And as I believe that the future is very rich for Freemasonry, I think it's important that we focus on what we can achieve collectively, because in 100 years we have a question to answer. And I'll ask you, how do you want to be remembered? How will we be defined? Certainly not by mediocrity. History is that keeper of natural law, and it is unrelenting, and there is no appeal. We are what we are. Time will define that more than us, more than our intentions, more than the gesture of good deed. Are we still capable of great ideas? Or are the greatest ideas of Freemasonry still to be defined? We rely on the development of tolerance. That wasn't new. It's not a democratic process. That's something that we have documented around the 10th and 11th century. Remind me to talk about that, one of the shows coming up. Tolerance isn't something that came out of battle. It came out of the mind. We are all inventors, each sailing out on a voyage of discovery guided by a private chart, of which there is no duplicate. The world is all gates, all opportunities. That comes from Ralph Waldo Emerson. We're unique. Yes, I hope one day I hold out that sense that I'd like to think in my mind's eye, we will have the great Grand Lodge building one day in Canada. I hope it's in Ontario. A structure that honors our commitment and expresses our ideas of the arts and sciences. Not something that is utilitarian and industrial looking, like so many of our buildings have been. We've been practical people. We've had to do the most with what we have. We're not a huge nation, but we are a growing nation. And by working together, we can accomplish more and greater things. But it's the cooperation that's always key, isn't it? You cannot plow a field by turning it over in your mind. Unless we take some action. These great ideas are not going to be recorded in history. What defines us? I certainly hope we realize that mediocre ideas are expressions of mediocrity that will define everything that we do. Great spirits have always encountered violent opposition from mediocre minds. If Einstein could say that, is it worth listening to? listening to him? Is it worth opening our mind? Remember, nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm. As we grow older, we tend to become a little hesitant when we hear things that are followed by enthusiasm. Some of us become dismissive, perhaps at our own peril. I'm going to talk to you about a fellow named Anthony Sayre, a gentleman who happened to be the first Grand Master. 2 years after his Grand Mastership, he was elected Senior Grand Warden in the reign of Dr. de Saulier. He was a member of number 3 of the 4 old lodges, of which he was warden in 1723, and remained a member until, at any rate, 1730. His financial circumstances seem to have been poor, and a petition from him is recorded in Grand Lodge minutes in 1724 that, with what result is not known. The second petition for relief was made in 1730, when the question having been put, it was agreed that he should have £15 on account of his having been Grand Master, and a final sum of 2 guineas was paid to him from the General Charity in 1741. More pleasant is it to picture Anthony Sayre as walking last in a procession of 10 Grand Masters arranged in order of juniority at the installation of the Duke of Norfolk in 1730. Unfortunately, the same year saw him arraigned before Grand Lodge on a complaint of his having committed irregularities, their nature not being specified. The deputy Grand Master told Brother Sayre that he was acquitted of the charge against him and recommended it to him to do nothing so irregular for the future. The equivalent of a verdict of not guilty, but don't do it again. At the time of his death in January 1742, he was Tyler of what is now the Old King's Arms Lodge, number 28. George Payne was the second and fourth Grand Master, duly invested, installed, congratulated, and homaged as Grand Master of Masons, after which he desired any brethren to bring to the Grand Lodge any old writings and records concerning Masons and Masonry in order to show the usages of ancient times. Anderson further states that during the year, several copies of the Gothic, manuscript constitutions were produced and collated. During his second term of office as the last commoner, Grand Master, 1720 to 1721, he produced the Cook manuscript in Grand Lodge, and also compiled the great regulations which were enshrined in Anderson's Constitutions of 1723. What was, from our point of view, a tragedy of this year was that in some private lodges, several valuable manuscripts, probably old charges, were too hastily burnt by some scrupulous brothers, that those papers may not fall into strange hands. What's it say? What's that say? I don't know. I wish they hadn't done it. I wish that rigidity were not part of the order. You know, it makes me think that I noticed that there are, in the news, people committing heinous crime. But they use, to justify it, they're intelligent enough to use the virtue and honor of very wonderful, wonderful religions and faith. But they use it and distort it into something that has little connection with their claim of authenticity and an authority, the moral high ground. And yet, their zealots go after our zealots, and our zealots go after their zealots. And in the middle, we sit and shake our heads. I wonder, when will it all stop? It's funny how these things trigger the thought. They burned the manuscripts. Payne was master number 4 lodge in 1723, and it was out of respect for him that Grand Lodge restored the lodge to its place in 1751. He was appointed Grand Junior Warden in 1725 and acted as Grand Master on a special occasion in 1735, continuing as an active member of Grand Lodge until 1754. The third Grand Master, and a man that has, and a brother that has fascinated me since I first discovered, Dr. John Theosophilus de Saulier. He was a lawyer and a minister. He succeeded Payne as the third Grand Master in 1719. He was of French descent and attractive personality, if forbidding aspect. He had been educated in Christ Church, Oxford, where he took orders in 1710. He left France. His father was a member of the clergy of the Huguenots, and the Huguenots were purged out of France, and that's why they came to England. This is a little part of the... I'm working from the pocket history of Freemasonry, of course. In the same year, 1710, he became a lecturer on experimental philosophy, and one of his books on this subject, published in 1734, he showed himself a prophet over 200 years before the event of the splitting of the atom. While Grand Master, it was recorded that he revived the old, regular, and peculiar toasts of health of the Freemasons. It was also during his rule that it was agreed that the Grand Master should have the power of appointing his Grand Wardens, who had hitherto been annually elected, and a Deputy Grand Master. The first Deputy Grand Master was Dr. John Beale, appointed by the Duke of Montaigne in 1921. Dr. de Saulier himself was Deputy Grand Master to the Duke of Wharton in 1722 and held the same office again in 1723 and 25. Like his predecessor, he was a staunch supporter of the General Charity when it came to be established in 1724. The highlight of his Masonic career may be said to have been his most famous visit to Edinburgh in 1721, which he undertook for professional reasons. But while there, he sought an interview at the Lodge of Edinburgh, the Master Masons of which, finding him duly qualified in all points of Masonry, received him as a brother into their society. This visit is believed to have had a considerable influence on the introduction of speculative Masonry into Scotland. It was Dr. de Saulier who was responsible for the initiation of the first Royal Freemasons. These were the Duke of Lorraine, who was admitted into the craft by the Doctor at the Hague in 1731, and Frederick, Prince of Wales, whose chaplain he was, at an occasional lodge at Kew Palace in 1737. On his death in 1744, he was buried in the Chapel Royal in the Savoy. His son, Lieutenant General Thomas de Saulier, who served for 57 years in the Royal Artillery, was a well-known Freemason, and the remarkable number of lodges in that corps during the second half of the 18th century may well have been due to his influence. A lineal descendant, Lord Shuttleworth, was Junior Grand Warden in 1952. Now, de Saulier, what this doesn't tell us was that de Saulier was the co-author of the Constitution. He worked with Anderson. Anderson was a Presbyterian minister, so they had that in the back. You know, they had similar thoughts. I remember that the first Constitution that they produced, they were given the manuscripts they had up to the time. That's why Payne's call was really interesting. And it makes me feel a little winsome that some fellows, perhaps zealous, burned. Anyway, life goes on for all of us. I hope you're doing well. I'm glad that you've come and joined me today. I hope you found this interesting. I've tried. We are going to get together again real soon. I appreciate your support. Commit as many acts, random acts of Masonic kindness, and stay in touch with one another. It's been great. traveling around. I got to Powassan, got to North Bay, got over to Maxville not too long ago. I'm looking forward to seeing you in one of my travels. Have fun.